Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. We're recording this on Wednesday, July 13th, 2016, five days before the beginning of the Republican National Convention that will, barring some astounding set of events in the next 5 days, see the nomination of Donald Trump as the Republican candidate for President of the United States. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, Abe Greenwald, our senior editor. Hello, Abe.
Hi, John.
And manning the machinery, Noah Rothman, assistant online editor. Hi, Noah.
Ahoy, John.
Gentlemen, the question that is consuming America over the last week is whether the country is falling apart and whether the culture is dividing and whether we are on the cusp of some kind of general national crisis in the wake of the two police shootings in Baton Rouge and Minneapolis, and then the sniper shooting of five policemen in Dallas. Much of the commentary seems to be dedicated to the notion that no, we're not falling apart, except yes, we are, and maybe we're not, but we are. It's sort of like the 60s, but it's not like the 60s, but it could be like the 60s, and it may be like the 60s. Abe, if, as John McLaughlin would have said, if one is America is in a utopian, is a utopian paradise in 2016, and 10 is America is in a state of cataclysmic ninth circle of hell monstrousness, where would you put us after last week?
Well, first of all, this is a dream come true. I get to play McLaughlin Group. At the risk of sounding terribly boring, somewhere in between, but a lot closer to a utopian paradise. I mean,
so are you saying four? Are you saying three? You got to pick a number.
I say if it's a binary choice, I go with the utopian paradise.
I wouldn't call it a binary choice. It's a scale of 1 to 10. Therefore, it's a
but there are two.
It's a decological choice.
You're supposed to say wrong.
Right.
It's a decological choice. Totally. So I'm saying if one is the utopian paradise and 10 is the ninth circle of hell, where are you on the scale?
I'm a 3.
A 3. Okay. Noah, where would you be on the scale?
I like 3. I'm going to go 4. I'm going to say 4.
Okay. Noah's at 4. Abe's at 3. I'm at 2 in reality and 5 in perception. So, by which I mean that America remains the freest, fairest, most remarkable place on earth, and its political system is remarkably powerful. It is still the engine of growth for the world. It's still the beacon of freedom for the world. It's still the place that if you were an unborn child getting to choose where it is that you would wish to be born, you would choose the United States over every other country on earth. Having said all that, the perception that we are falling apart is now so general that the perception can start affecting the reality, and we have a kind of conspiracy of the extremes to convince people who are not on the extremes that this is true. Republicans argue, or conservatives argue, that the Obama years, the lawlessness, the unconstitutionality of the Obama years has frayed the political and social contract to the extent that we are heading toward an antinomian, imposed, pseudo-socialist, semi-totalitarian future. And the liberals, leftists, and Democrats argue that rampant inequality is leading to a stratified society in which freedom only attains for those who can afford it, and under those conditions, social unrest is of the sort that we've seen in the past week in response to the police shootings is not only inevitable but justified and indeed potentially purifying. So those are the extremes. And the question is how much those extremes start crowding in the sense on the center. This is where I would say it's very much different from the 1960s, because in the 1960s, in fact, America was falling apart as an actual practical matter. Crime was on a ravaging upswing. The inner cities were literally burning down in the riots of 1968. We had 500,000 men at arms in Vietnam who were being sacrificed in pursuit of an effort that seemed to have no purpose that anyone could explain seriously or defend or advocate for. And all of these things showed us inflation was rising and...
Two high-profile assassinations in that year.
Exactly. So we really were coming apart in 1968. And in 2016, what are the circumstances? We have random acts of... Or random, geographically random acts of police violence... And scattered moments of either ideological or psychotic rage that is ideological in nature, making everybody feel terribly unsafe in various places, even though crime continues to be astoundingly low. The economy is growing, although it's not growing that fast. Inflation is staggeringly low. We actually have social peace and not any... visible forms of terrific social unrest, and yet we do obviously have a sense that 70%, 75% of the country thinks it's on the wrong track and incomes aren't growing fast enough and all of that, but that is still nothing like the dislocations of 50 years ago.
I feel like the level of social anxiety that we encounter in our environment, which is a very self-selected, sequestered, highly politicized environment that includes you, dear listener, if you're listening to this, you're part of the tribe, that I don't encounter that kind of anxiety among people who don't consume the news as much as we do. I don't feel like when I go outside and I talk to my neighbors who are not news consumers at the level that we are, that they feel like there is a real sense of social unease, that there is incredible economic stagnation, that there is a rise of crime and racial anxiety and unrest. That sort of thing is palpable and real and legitimate among people who are followers of politics. But I don't encounter that in an anecdotal sense. And I wonder whether or not we're just hypersensitive to it.
Well, I mean, I think what we're hypersensitive to the perception of it, I suppose. But I think specifically because of something that I suspect is different today than was also different from the 60s is that there's no matchup. People are protesting and fighting, and what unrest there is sort of seems to stem from this purely impressionistic story. It's not connected to data. It's not connected to actual goings on, and that in a way makes it sort of harder to combat and harder to sort of come back together and unify, because if you can't say, hey, the poor in America are actually living materially better than they did 25 years ago, police violence against minorities is at an historic low, if you can't bring people back in to a sense of shared reality with those facts, then how do you stop at least a certain segment from spiraling out of control?
And that's where you get to the perception and reality thing, which is that perception can become reality over time, if in fact there are no solutions that can be proffered. One of the things about 50 years ago is that the left had very specific, although incredibly wrongheaded, solutions. We should lose the war in Vietnam, effectively. We should become a socialist country. We should imitate, we should be more like Cuba, in some cases more like the Soviet Union to other people. There was a utopian sense that the Great Society might indeed lead to the elimination of poverty, and that it was just more commission of resources, that if you did radical acts of desegregation, including busing and forced integration, that would alter the dynamic of American society for the better. There was an optimism to the liberal war on, let's say, on the prevailing American culture that liberalism no longer has, and that also gave rise to a very significant sotto voce conflict between people who believed that America was wrong or evil or on the wrong track, and a whole bunch of Americans, the people that Richard Nixon called the silent majority, who believed in America, believed in the American experiment, did not like to see their country run down, and drove the Democratic Party into almost, you know, with the sole exception of Jimmy Carter, which was a sort of freakish election in 1976, it was a 28-year gap, basically, or 24-year gap for Democrats getting to the White House for this very reason, that they were perceived as people who did not believe in the United States sufficiently to be given the reins of power. Now we have a Republican nominee in Donald Trump who does not believe in the United States in a manner that is quite similar, I would say, to certain kinds of objections in the 1960s. In an odd way, that, you know, that the country is failing everybody, and it's all rigged, and the system is horrible and corrupt and monstrous, and only he, a person who himself has benefited from the horrible, corrupt monstrousness of the system, knows where the bodies are buried and knows how to unlock the potential of the country. And there is no one in this election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump who is actually going to stand up as a kind of American, as a believer, not only in the American project, but in America as it is now. Nobody in this country now believes in the United States as it is now. That's a recipe for some form of emotional meltdown, certainly, if not practical meltdown.
And I would suggest that has a lot to do with the fact that this is the president's legacy, and he's sort of flailing in response to what he's staring down the barrel at, which is a series of disasters abroad and a bifurcated culture at home, which he's exacerbated at times for political gain. And his defenders will really take exception to that, and they will run to their corners and be very defensive about how this president has approached social conflict. And there are times when he has performed quite admirably, but that's very selective on his part. For the most part, he has sought to exacerbate social tensions for political gain in really tense moments that have a lot to do with racial tension. And he's demonstrated, for example, in the wake of the Trayvon Martin verdict in 2013, I think it was, where he was extremely eloquent on race relations and had a real calming effect. And there are other opportunities that he's declined to pursue that course. And he's now staring down the barrel at a legacy in which polls reflect and anecdotal evidence suggests that race relations are in a backslide in the United States. And that really will stick to him more than I think a lot of other things will, because of the amount of expectations that were on his shoulders when it came to race relations in this country in 2009. Be those expectations maybe were artificially inflated or imposed on him by his supporters, that's possible. But he most certainly has not lived up to them.
I think it's very difficult for liberals and leftists in this country, and Obama is a left liberal, to look at the panoply of difficulties facing African Americans and poor Latinos and other minority groups and not immediately default to the notion that the society as a whole is guilty of causing the problems that people face as groups, and that it is the primary responsibility of government to repair this fault line or repair this damage, rather than taking the view that the United States, with all its flaws and with the terrible things that are going on, is still the freest and the best place for any individual person of any race to be born and in which to grow up, and that most of the failings that most of the difficulties that practical problems that people face, some of them are economically structural in the sense that they are the result of very large and very complex forces, globalization and indeed trade and various others, but that they are personal, that the difficulties that people face often stem from the nature of the household in which they grow up, the difficulties of the chaos in which they live. I'm reading an extraordinary book just now called Hillbilly Elegy by J.D. Vance, essentially a first-generation college graduate from what he unashamedly calls a hillbilly family. He himself grew up in Ohio, but his grandparents, the place that he considers home, is grandmother's home in a holler in Kentucky. And he discusses in this remarkable book how the incredible virtues of this kind of Scotch-Irish world, deep, fierce loyalty both to country and to family and to a very rigid sense of right and wrong about how to treat people, and you'll give people the shirt off your back and you'll show incredible kindness to a passing stranger and all of that, but unbelievable pride and the assumption that you do no wrong and that wrongs are done to you and that it is your job to correct the wrongs that are done to you, and that this creates a multi-generational circumstance in which people do not take responsibility for their actions. And with the arrival in particular of the opioid epidemic, where it has become astoundingly easy for people to drown, just as people drown their sins in alcohol once, but now they drown their sins in opioids in a way that makes it almost impossible for them to be productive, and that they all basically, the entire superstructure, emotional, moral superstructure in which they live, means that they are not responsible for who they are and what they do. And that is a story that Obama occasionally sneaks up, walks up to the line to tell about the United States and about suffering people in the United States and about the responsibilities of parents and the responsibilities of individual households to take care of their kids and to get off drugs and to make sure their kids do their homework and to make sure that their kids see that they have a future and all that. And he does that occasionally, and then he backs off and basically assents to this idea that there is a vast number of victims in the United States. And Donald Trump, of course, plays exactly into that same narrative, only his victims are J.D. Vance's people and not the people for whom Black Lives Matter supposedly speak. By the way, the hillbillies in Hillbilly Elegy feel much the same way about law enforcement that we hear, you know, African Americans do right now. They view law enforcement with great suspicion. It's an outside force. All it wants to do is divide you up and, you know, make you guilty and handle you, and you keep your mouth shut. You don't tell them anything. You never tell them anything because they're just gonna screw you and your family over. Well, and of course, it's very easy for people in a position of privilege who make money and who blah blah to, you know, talk about this in this condescending way, and we shouldn't condescend because we have no idea what it is that these people go through and the pain, the sorrow, and the agony. And I'm sure that's true. I have no argument with that idea. It doesn't mean that we don't have, you know, 5-10,000 years of civilized history to show us that the refusal to accept responsibility for yourself and your actions is the core root of a civil society.
And I, you know, the thing is, personal responsibility is a very hard political sell in 2016. You know,
it's not on the ballot.
No, to come out and say here's our idea. Expect less stuff and do some more, you know.
But that's the pure essence of what John was just saying.
Oh yeah, it's right. Oh yeah, no, I know. But the culture is such now that it's
that this is the essence of Americanism, is the 19th century promise, is that you can get as far as your feet will take you in this country. And no one is defending that prospect in 2016.
Right. Well, the presumption is Donald Trump says it's rigged because the politics are rigged. And Bernie Sanders and now increasingly Hillary Clinton or the Democrat platform say it's rigged because the top 1% have the system rigged. And if we're a rigged country, then you are, every one of us is a puppet dangling on the end of a string. And that's just the way life is. And a country that believes that about, comes to believe that about itself, cannot be a self-governing country for too much longer.
That was also the agitprop message that was broadcast into the United States out of the Soviet Union for quite some time. That this is a rigged system, a failed system. You cannot get ahead. There is a cabal of oligarchs who are controlling your lives. And the only answer is to embrace revolution.
Now, you know, there is an idea abroad on the right, a very interesting and radical idea, promulgated largely, an old idea of actually Milton Friedman's, but promulgated right now by Charles Murray, who loves to promulgate radical ideas, that the structure of society in the 21st century is such that productivity gains are simply going to increase and indeed possibly increase exponentially, and that there will simply be no need for a workforce as large as the workforce that we are generating as a matter of natural course, and an unskilled workforce in particular. That the great example that is often used in this realm is that the self-driving car powered by an app from your phone will eliminate 5 million jobs in the United States. People who drive for a living, taxis, car services, trucks, all kinds of things. And if these become self-propelling machines in the next 40 or 50 years, that the one primary source of work for unskilled labor is simply going to vanish. And what's going to take its place? So Murray proposes, in line with Milton Friedman, something called the universal basic income. And according to this doctrine, every person in the United States will get a $13,000 check from the government at the beginning of every year. $3,000 goes to a catastrophic health insurance program policy, and the $10,000 is for you to support yourself. And all other social programs are eliminated. So that, and the idea then is that you on the one hand grant the fact that people need a basic income, and that without it they will starve, but they will not be put in a position of constant peonage to the government, where they get a little bit here, they get a little bit there, they get a food stamp, they get an earned income tax credit over there, they get a little bit of money over here, you get a little bit of an SSI benefit over there, and then they sew it all together into a subsistence income and live like that. It's a fascinating notion. It obviously flies in the face of almost everything that we would conventionally think of as American, the idea that people essentially get a paid stipend from the government to be alive, and the potential unintended consequences of such a thing are very easily imagined. But point here is that even there you see a kind of belief that we cannot sustain this national experiment without some radical dislocative change.
Our own John Steele Gordon wrote a piece on that and some experiments to that effect that are ongoing in Europe. And it seems to me that conservatives have been far more open to that idea and that prospect of a minimum income in exchange for a lot of reduction in the expansive social welfare program, the social safety net, than our Democrats. And that makes perfect sense, or liberals rather, and progressives. That makes perfect sense because it removes a lot of responsibility from the public sector. The government does two things really well. It kills things and breaks things through the military, and it writes checks. And writing checks, if that's all you have to do, is something you can really trust the government to do effectively.
Well, and it does it effectively. The obvious model for such a universal basic income is the Social Security system, which writes a check to everybody over 65 in the United States. And it's a system that works so efficiently that there, you've never heard of a single case in which somebody says, I don't get my check. I don't, my money isn't deposited in my account. So we know the system would work. But yeah, the problem here would be, and why it's why Charles Murray, who is a libertarian, likes the idea, is that it's an assault on big government in an odd way. That it would completely dismantle the superstructure of the program and support system that, you know, I don't know what number of jobs, federal jobs and state level jobs, although this would not really involve the state, this is a federal issue, the universal basic income, but, you know, what number of jobs is, you know, basically dependent on being the person who writes the check or who administers the program that's supposed to be so helpful.
Now, does he, and I haven't read the book yet, but
the book is called In Our Hands, and you can get it online. It's published by the American Enterprise Institute. It's a revised version of something that Charles wrote in 2006, and to call it provocative is to understate the case. It's short, it's pithy, it's very well argued, and it's well worth your time. You're going to be hearing a lot more about this over the next decade.
Does he address the question of sort of lost sense of purpose and idleness?
Yeah, but I think the point in the book is that the lost sense of purpose and idleness are what this is intended proactively to address, that idleness and lost sense of purpose are going to be the fate of tens of millions of people in this country simply by dint of the development of the 21st century economy.
Now, so this is how they live.
This is how they will live.
Right, this is how they will live.
And therefore, the question is whether some kind of spirit of entrepreneurship can be, by providing them with capital that isn't just human capital, but is actually physical capital, though it is intended to provide subsistence money for a person and for a family, will that kick people in? Will that incubate in them a sense of purpose that the larger society can no longer provide through the manufacture of, you know, of mass jobs?
We have the answer to that question. The notion that throwing money at people will provide them a sense of comfort and self-satisfaction in industry is, there's just no examples of that in recent history.
Right, but since most of the cases in which we know money is given, but with strings, and the strings then tangle people up in bureaucracy, and they knit them and wed them to bureaucratic systems that make it impossible for them, that increase the difficulty of them escaping it. That would be the argument that is made. Noah, your objection is the objection to such an idea, that this is, that this will, that the, not only does it, is it counterintuitive to assume that you can engender a spirit of individuality in people whose basic font income comes from the collective, but that you won't create a gigantic system of unintended consequences, people having 12 or 14 children simply to get that $10,000, you know, so that they can boost their income to $140,000. And these are children they don't want to have and have no interest in having and will mistreat and will neglect and will have a terrible
That's set of welfare. Well, my objection is that this is the end of history, that we've somehow encountered some sort of technological advanced age and economic shift that we've never encountered before, and as a result, we need some sort of wild solution to it. Every conservatives all had a good hearty chuckle at Barack Obama in 2010 when he blamed airport kiosks and ATMs for economic displacement, but he was actually correct insofar as he was identifying automation as a source of economic displacement for people who are lower skilled labor or not college educated labor. And we've encountered major societal economic fundamental shifts at the start of just about every century. and we're there again. And we didn't have social safety nets and big expansive government programs, and there was a lot of hardship and suffering as a result, something that we probably cannot accept anymore as a society just because of the spotlight that would be on individuals who are in those circumstances.
I don't think it's just the spotlight, to be fair. I don't think it's just the spotlight. We are a, honestly, though, in fact, there may be all sorts of unintended consequences, we are a kinder and more generous society than we used to be. It was just presumed that people, you know, that people were poor or that, you know, terrible things happened. It was nobody's business, and you took care of your own, and we don't live like that anymore, and there are consequences to that, and there are benefits. There are moral and social benefits, and there are terrible consequences as well. But it's an interesting intellectual exercise, at the very least, to say, if Bernie Sanders says the top 1% are eating everything up, and what we need to do is a massive act of income redistribution so that it's just fairer and things are fairer and they get less and other people get more, then you simply have a wholesale government act of redistribution on the part of the public sector, a sort of war against the private sector and the way it has organized itself in the face of contemporary life, as opposed to the notion that, okay, so here's the situation. We have a social welfare system that doesn't really work very well. We will repurpose the money, write everybody a check, and say, you know, good luck to you. And we will not have government impede the private sector from creating the potential innovations that will solve the problem over time that is created by this. It's not just automation. It's this just massive leap in productivity. It just takes fewer people to do work than it took to do work 40 or 50 years ago. It takes half as many people, or two-thirds, or a third as many people to do lots of things in our own business, in media. I began working as a researcher at Time Magazine, a job category at news magazines. Granted, there were three news magazines, so it's not that big. But it employed, let's say, 500 people in a universe of 10,000 people. And that position, that job, no longer exists. It was a middleman position that no longer exists, because automation and all sorts of advances made it unnecessary. Google made it unnecessary, among other things. You don't need a separate researcher to check your facts. You can check your facts as you go.
So the argument, the long-standing argument that when such jobs are lost, they necessarily create new ones elsewhere, what comes of that?
Well, it's obviously not true. That's part of the reason that we have this kind of secular stagnation that everybody's talking about. In other words, like, jobs are created, different jobs are created, but they're not better necessarily. And the whole notion that that the country had this system where, just like General Motors, you had I can't remember what the levels were, but you started with the cheap car, and then you went up to the Chevrolet, and then you went up to the Buick, and then you went up to the Cadillac, and that's how you lived your life as well. Life now takes a much different, you know, you go from a settled, comfortable, safe job to a much more insecure existence, right?
That is precisely what progressives are saying, and they are standing athwart the sharing economy yelling stop. That just evolved. That happened radically out of nowhere, that we had people who were saying, I have an asset, a home, an apartment, a car, I'm going to use it to make extra money. And that, not only doing that did they have extra money, but they also had opportunity and more time to invest that opportunity in ways that are more efficient and productive. And it's the progressives and Democrats who are standing and holding up taxi medallions and union privileges for people in hospitality and saying that this is the way it's been and it should be. And those are the people who are standing away of innovation that is happening radically and from the grassroots up.
Well, that's exactly right. And why is that happening? Because interest groups use government as a lever to impede this kind of progress. That you have that kind of progress, that's the individual sharing economy. You have the greatest assault on, there's a certain sense ideologically, the greatest assault on government, 19th century government structuring is the charter school movement, since, of course, the American schooling is still based on this 19th century factory model that is insanely outdated, that follows an agricultural schedule in which people get, kids get 3 months off. And if you're a parent, you know what a hardship it is to have to deal with children with 3 months of free time when you don't have, you yourself work a 12-month schedule and don't have time to, you know, take them off to skip and frolic in the daisies for months. And and so the charter school is the answer to this.
That or child labor.
Right. Well, there you go. But the innovation that is necessary to reform a system in the face of modern, and the fact that, you know, 1% of Americans have farms now, so the entire structure of the family household isn't based around the planting and harvesting season, that's gone. And yet we have this colossal machinery that stands in the way of changing the way American schooling works, just like we have that machinery impeding the progress of the sharing economy. And it is, you know, it is that is the horrible downside of the notion that the solution to our problems is to tax rich people more, which may be emotionally satisfying, but A, as we know, doesn't work very well as a form of getting of income redistribution, and B, doesn't have the effect of growing the economy at all. Having said that, the economy doesn't grow very much now, and so we do have structural problems in the fact that a lot of money goes to the financial sector, which doesn't employ anybody.
Okay, I just went from a 3 to a 4.
Okay, there you go. So you see the perception problem. Well, yeah. You know who else has a perception problem is Hillary Clinton. You know why she has a perception problem? Because James Comey perceived that she basically was a crook but didn't indict her. And after a year in which she gave 3 or 4 catastrophic interviews and monstrous, terribly damaging interviews trying to explain away the obvious fecklessness at best and criminality at worst of her email system and the ways in which she may have been trying to hide her connections to her husband's foundation and its money-making system. Here we have Hillary Clinton taking a huge beating in the polls this week. Trump now within striking distance of her, all over the place. And what can she do? It seems to me there's very little she can do because she can't open herself up to talking to anybody. She can't talk to an interviewer. She can't talk to a town hall. She can't talk to nobody without having to answer the question. And the first time she had to answer the question last week, she said that James Comey was wrong. So Comey saved her by not indicting her. And she then had to attack him for even daring to say that she had done anything wrong. She's got real problems communicating between now and November.
Yeah, but I have a hard time believing that this email scandal is going to follow her in the same way it has this week in the wake of this FBI thing. That really put a period on the end of that sentence. And while this is a structural problem with her that is not disappearing, it's not going away, it's real, it's a question about her competence, and I think she's frankly compromised to a point where it's practically a national security risk to put her in the White House. At the same time, the issue has been resolved, and she doesn't have to keep answering questions about it if she doesn't want to. She can say that the FBI basically absolved me. The Department of Justice basically absolved me. This is an issue that's your fixation.
You don't want to say the FBI absolved me.
Well, not in those terms.
That's the problem. Even having to answer a question raises the issue.
Right.
But, well, she can project. She can say that this is your fixation. It's not the government's.
But she doesn't think it's over because she's not getting out there talking about it. I mean, if there's a period on it, no one's told her. I mean, I think it's going to dog her. I think it has to. It's kind of an extraordinary circumstance because it's almost like she can't talk in a year where sort of incautious blabbing is like the coin of the realm, you know. maybe that'll help her. I it can't help her for long. I mean, you can't, she can't stay sort of holed up as the candidate. Yeah.
Well, the trajectory of these things, if this was a normal year, which it is not, would be that we go into the conventions and there's unity and hand-holding and everybody sings We Are the World, and you come out of them with some mutual bumps. Trump gets a bump. Hillary gets a bump. We enter into the general campaign, and then it's all about parrying and dodging and debates, and the fundamentals really dictate who's going to win the White House, and we have a bunch of mini-scandals that don't really amount to much, but we fixate on them for a little bit. So the pieces of this puzzle should, if it was a normal year, should really be set by the end of mid-July, beginning of August.
Well, if that's the case, then Trump gets a bump and Hillary gets a bump. Trump's next week. Hillary's the week after. Trump will name his VP and the convention will go okay for him, which we don't know if it will. Certainly the convention will go okay for her. And the cast of Hamilton will perform, and it'll be great. And there'll be Beyonce will sing, and that'll be great. And you know, who knows what'll happen? And then the race will, in theory, settle into the race that it is now. And while Hillary has got terrible troubles here, and Trump had a good week because she had a bad week, he's still at around 40%. I mean, she's now, one poll, the Quinnipiac poll, has him up in Florida and up in Pennsylvania. Still, you know, basically down in Ohio, but everything's within the margin of error and they're neck and neck and all of that. But, you know, in some ways you could say that a more conventional candidate on the Republican side would have had a 10-point bump after last week. Would have been able to speak to her problems more in sorrow than in anger, would have handled it better, wouldn't have given two psychotic speeches in successive nights in which he couldn't focus on what it was that she had done, but had to start talking about whether or not it was okay for him to use a mug and David on Hillary's face with dollar bills behind it for half an hour. That's why you can never tell whether or not, I have no doubt, I have no proof of this, but I have no doubt that a candidate who did not do what he did last week would have seen a much more favorable polling atmosphere this week than Trump has. This is the best week of his since, you know, he became the nominee. And where is he? He's about where he was, and Hillary's fallen because of her condition. So he hasn't gained. She's fallen. It's the same pattern we've now seen, which is that her numbers go up and down and up and down and up and down, and he is mired at 40%. And that's either a floor or a ceiling, or it's both.
You know, and the thing is, external circumstances keep conspiring him to sort of give him gifts. You know, Hillary, the Comey announcement, Ginsburg slamming him, Justice Ginsburg slamming him. What better sort of evidence for him to say, see, it's all rigged, it's all this big thing, they're set against me, they're set against us, and he instead of using all that to his advantage.
Yeah. And more indeed, the issue set that was raised last week, which is that you have liberals and leftists lining up with violent protesters and cops being assaulted. As they are attempting simply to allow these protests to continue, and then of course the horrible, monstrous sniper attack on the police, and then you have a very clear dividing line, which is Hillary can't, as Jonathan Tobin says today on our blog, Hillary is in a position where she can't faint to the center to talk about how we can't do this to the police and we have to come together and the police are what to keep us safe, because she can't afford to offend African-American racial activists right now, because she needs gigantic racial turnout in order to win in November.
At the same time, this also kind of disproves a theory that was kind of prominent among pundits and columnists, that all bad news redounded to Trump's benefit, whatever that bad news was. And that kind of was challenged a little bit over the course of the spring, but the summer has utterly debunked it. Because again, as you said, if that assault, that attack on police officers by a radical black activist was going to do anything politically, it was going to redound to Donald Trump's benefit. And we haven't really seen anything along those lines.
By the way, the other aspect of the polling this week that is really interesting is that a gap has opened up in state after state between Republican Senate candidates and Trump, which is the polar reverse of 2012, in which the whole argument that Romney was the problem with the, you know, Romney should have won and he didn't win because he left votes on the table all over the place, was disproved by the fact that Romney ran ahead of the Republican Senate candidates in state after state after state, including Ted Cruz and various others. And right now, in state after state after state, Republicans who are in challenging, have a challenging atmosphere in which they are running ahead of Trump. Richard Burr is running ahead of Trump in North Carolina. Kelly Ayotte is running ahead of Trump in New Hampshire. Rubio is running ahead of Trump in Florida. McCain is running ahead of Trump in Arizona. So everywhere you look, in fact, the numbers suggest that the Republican, despite the fact that Republicans hate the Republican Party and everything like that, Republicans qua Republicans, or these states, are still the states that they were in 2014 when the Republicans had this, you know, remarkable string of victories. And Trump is the dragging element.
Well, they better hope that holds, because the top of the ticket has made it very clear that he doesn't think it's all that necessary to have Republican majorities in Congress. He said to the New York Times today that it would be great, but it doesn't really matter. I can be a quote-unquote free agent if I want to be. And he told, apparently, according to reporting, Jeff Flake, who's not up in 2016, as he had to remind Donald Trump, that he would be more than happy to campaign against him on the stump over the course of this campaign if he doesn't fall in line behind him. And whether if we have any holdouts when he's the nominee, he'll make good on that promise. He's been very clear that he will attack his own side. He's practically more comfortable, I think, attacking Republicans than he is attacking Democrats. So he might do his best to be as big a drag on the ticket as possible, because if he's going down, I think he would like to take a few people with him.
It's possible, and indeed, you know, I think the most interesting Senate race in the country is the race between Maggie Hassan and Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire. You have a popular former governor and a popular senator, both women, obviously, both very much characters of their state. They are running very close; 1 or 2 points divide them. And I think it's pretty clear that it's a lot of what is going to determine what happens in that race in November is what happens at the top of the ticket. If they run that razor thin from here to there, you know, if Trump depresses 200,000 Republicans in New Hampshire enough that they don't come out and vote on Election Day, Ayotte will lose. And if Hillary is the single most uninspiring candidate who has ever lived, and 150,000 people stay home in New Hampshire, Hassan will lose. So we're just in an interesting atmosphere here, where the closer the race is, the more the extremely unpredictable dynamic with these two extremely unpopular and let's face it, unqualified and undignified and inappropriate candidates for president. Both of them are, the most horrifying analogy that one could think of, and I'm using it only in absurdly. I would compare anybody to anything, and I'm not comparing, but you know, it is like the Iran-Iraq war, in which famously everybody said that you sort of hope they both lost. So, you know, that's, you come to November, if you have two candidates, one of them's going to be president, you just hope, and, you know, a lot of people are hoping that they both lose. That's like a first. And by the way, the numbers are now showing this too. You know, we have these polls in which the Green Party is pulling from Hillary and the Libertarians are pulling from Trump. And if those, you know, if those parties remain relatively strong, we could have a very unpredictable election night. You know, if the Greens get 4%, you know, to sort of do what Nader did in 2000 and again, you know, to Gore, but there's a Libertarian getting 5 or 6% from Trump, you know.
And it sort of speaks to what we began the conversation with about a national crisis of confidence in the American mission statement, to sort of just meander zombie-like into this predicament in which we have these two really compromised candidates and no will to resist it, despite a lot of discomfort with that reality and despite the fact that it could still be averted. But there doesn't seem to be any interest in exercising the agency that you would have thought you'd seen in a republic that really does believe in its own virtue.
Well, and it will have to demonstrate its own virtue despite its political system, which, of course, was really the story of the 19th century in the United States. We had political system was terrible. A series of horrendous presidents from 1840 to 1860. Then God delivered us Abraham Lincoln and, you know, saved the country. And then we had a spate of horrendous candidates for another 25 years after that, and bad Supreme Court justices and corrupt Congresses and all sorts of terrible stuff. So it's not as though the country hasn't seen a circumstance in which it had to handle itself while the political system stalemated.
And economic depressions and...
Four serious economic depressions in the United States between 1850 and 1900. Four.
All coinciding with industrialization, rapid industrialization, and a lot of economic displacement as a result. And yet we survived, and nobody had a minimum income.
Right, so there you go. So you're not getting, if Noah's king, you're not getting a minimum income. Okay, you got it? Noah Rothman is not giving you a minimum income.
I'm not against the minimum income, as long as it's coupled with a real reduction in the entitlement state. Which I don't think will ever happen.
Right. That's the point that anti-tax activists always make, which is that if you say we really need a carbon tax because that would be good, you know, for conservation, that may be true. But then the question is, are you just adding another tax? Maybe if you put on a carbon tax, but you reduced a different tax, then the country could function more effectively. You know, so you controlled carbon, but you then didn't make sure that the, you know, average taxpayer was, you know, slammed. So there's the problem with the minimum income. The excitement of the minimum income brings us to the end of another commentary podcast. I don't think that we're going to have one next week because I'm going to be in Cleveland for the convention, dodging flying bottles and angry Trump delegates and weeping never Trumpers. So we'll be back, I guess, in 2 weeks. Remember, commentarymagazine.com, $19.95 buys you complete, unrestricted access to the magazine, its archives, our blog. $29.99 gets you a beautiful 11 times a year hardcover, softcover magazine that we produce lovingly here at our plant, high atop the Garment Center in New York City for Abe Greenwald and Noah Rothman. I'm John Podhoretz, and keep the candle burning.